Famed remote viewer Ingo Swann saw structures on the far side of the moon. Richard C. Hoagland, who will join us next hour, sees structures on the moon. John Lear, our special guest tonight, sees structures on the moon. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, this is going to be one of those programs where even if I wasn't hosting this show, I'd be glued to the radio. John Lear is a retired airline captain, former CIA pilot, as well as the son of the very famous inventor of the Lear jet. He's a Lockheed L-1011 captain, highly regarded in aviation circles. He has flown more than 150 test aircraft. He has won every award granted by the Federal Aviation Administration, and he holds 18 world speed records. He's worked for 28 different aircraft corporations, and during the late 1980s and early 1990s, John began coming forward with startling revelations concerning the subject of aerial phenomena and unidentified flying objects. He's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, John. How are you?
Good evening, George. It's an honor to be on your show again, and I think you are the best radio show host, bar none.
Well,
I wanted to tell you I enjoyed our time together at the Bay Area UFO Conference, and I'm sorry we didn't get to spend more time.
I got to tell you, it is a delight for me after so many years to interview guests like you, like Richard, and then when I meet you for the first time, it's really a treat for me. I mean, I never get over it. I'm still like a kid when I meet my very favorite baseball player when I was a little guy. It's the same kind of feeling, John, so it was great being with you, too.
That's great, and I want to thank or say hello to Bad Boy, the Nighthawk Zone, Spike Mike of Fantastic Forum, and my buddies at AboveTopSecret.com, which are Springer, and Skeptic Overlord and Simon Gray, who have helped me put this program together, and my associates Ron Schmidt and in Las Vegas and Beth in Florida.
Great. And I want to remind everyone, John has sent us some pictures, which are up on the coasttocoastam.com website. We're going to make some reference to them throughout the night. Get up there when you get a moment and just start taking a look at them. You know, John, your credentials are absolutely incredible. And the fact that you have been able to investigate and talk about some of these fantastic things that are happening on this planet and in this universe just adds so much credibility to it. There aren't a lot of people like you who come forward that you stick your neck out and say, hey, look, this is what's going on. But I'm beginning to feel like people with credentials like yours are beginning to do that now. Am I right in that feeling?
Yeah, most of the guys that know what's going on are hampered by their security clearance. But tonight I'd like to talk about how the government has been mining on the moon for the past 40 years and how the public, Congress, and most everyone else have been kept out of the loop. How Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, Space Lab, the shuttle, and the International Space Station are all cover for what's really going on. As a matter of fact, we first started sending men to the moon in 1962. We were going to Mars in 1966 and have traveled throughout the solar system since then. And tonight, I'm going to show you the photographs taken by NASA themselves that will show mining operations currently in operation. And these are not artifacts of ancient civilizations on the moon. This is going on here and now.
Why covert, John? Why not just announce to the public, hey, we're on the moon, we're mining, we're getting minerals, we're doing all these things?
Yeah, that's what I want the listeners to email Michael Griffin, who's head of NASA, and ask him, why is this a secret?
Yeah, so we really don't know what's going on, do we?
No.
John, let's go back just a little bit before we get into this. Tell me about your interest in the aerial phenomena, the unidentified flying objects, something obviously captured your imagination and your attention.
It was Bud Hopkins' book, Missing Time. I remember picking it up off the table at a friend of mine, Al Newell, here in Las Vegas, and I looked at that thing and I said, what's this? And I started reading it, and George, I'm telling you, the shivers went up my spine. I said, this is real. And one thing led to another. I eventually got to meet Bud in New York, and it was kind of funny because I was flying for American Transair, and I was so anxious to meet him that I had just come over from a flight from Paris. I had all my bags and my bag and my flight bag and my hang-up bag, and I went directly to Bud Hopkins' house, And I rang the doorbell, and when he answered it, he was in a kind of looked shocked. He thought I was moving in, and all I did is, you know, I had my stuff from the flight. And so anyway, we hit it off good, and he tried to do a regression. He said, look, you can't have this interest without, you know, having been involved, and nothing came of it, but that's what started it. Bud Hopkins' book, Missing Time.
You took a little hiatus for a while, and now you're coming back strong again.
Yeah, I had a little time there when I thought that maybe I shouldn't be talking about this, but fortunately that passed, and now I'm back.
All right. Well, do you still get calls from some of your friends and colleagues who have flown, and do they still pass information on to you?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the airline I left, which was not ATA, a couple of months ago, had a funny thing. The flight engineer called me. He said, you're not going to believe this. He said, "This is." They were in a 747 headed towards Seattle from back east, and they were over Chicago. It was at night, late at night, and they're headed westbound, and the center comes on and says, traffic 12 o'clock, 20 miles, 2,000 feet below you. And so they're looking out for this traffic below them, and here comes this huge white object, and it comes almost to within a mile of their craft, and then just instantaneously heads for the north and disappears in about 5 seconds. And they're all sitting there stunned, and the co-pilot finally says, now there's something you don't see every day. And, of course, they all burst out laughing.
Tell me a little bit about some of these photos that you gave us that we have posted on the website.
Okay, we have the photos starting with Apollo 8-12, 2209. It shows a picture of the Lomonosov crater, and what it shows is a city. And I'll tell you how I got into this. A few years ago, somebody sent me some pictures by Art Sweeney, who did drawings of stuff on the moon
right.
that he could see through a telescope. And that put me into a friend who called me Bob Chirilla in Chicago, and he said, when you're in town, I want to show you something. And he showed me a book written by a guy named Charrington in Canada, who had a really good photograph of Lunar Orbiter 2162, and that was an oblique photo of Copernicus. And he showed me some tanks, vertical, you know, tanks, four huge ones standing up on the hillside, and that's posted in the pictures you got. That led me, about the same time, I saw Richard Hoagland's Moon-Mars connection about the six-mile-high object in the middle of Sinus Medi.
Right.
And so I ordered some photos from NASA of these pictures of Copernicus. Here's the deal, Jordan. Here's how it got so interesting. Somebody, now when you order pictures from NASA, you don't order it from them. You order it from National Space Science Data Center, one of the mm-hmm. contractors. Somebody sent me, and I'll never know who it was, a 16 by 20 negative of 162H, Lunar Orbiter 2, oblique photo of Copernicus, which had not been airbrushed at all.
Oh.
And that stuff is, anybody can look at it. It's at abovetopsecret.com. You can go to that website and see that thing. What happened is I had no way to print a 16 by 20 negative. So that thing sat in my garage for 2 or 3 years until the technology got to the point where I could go to go downtown mm-hmm. and get somebody to print it. When I did, it was spectacularly clear. I took it over to Bob Lazar's, and it was so big that he had to make four different scans of it, and those are on abovetopsecret.com. And we started looking at it, and it was just really interesting. Those photos sat around for maybe 2 or 3 years, and then finally I went to abovetopsecret.com, and they wanted to put them on their forum, which they did. And it attracted so much interest. I think that one forum now, or that one thread, has got over 130,000 views now. And people started to contribute. Yeah, I see this, I see that. And we just amassed all these things that were going on Copernicus. It's obviously a mining operation. You can look at the photos that I gave to Lex that are posted on C2C. Mm-hmm. You can see cranes. You can see excavators. You can see buildings. It's all there. And then a few weeks ago, actually, it was around my birthday, I got to thinking, geez, I wonder if there's anything else. And I pulled out a book out of my library, and I went to that great library, great book place in Portland a few years ago, and cleaned them out of every NASA book they had. And a lot of them were printed way back in the 70s, which is before NASA got real talented with their airbrush. And I got this book called SP-246, and it's photos of Apollo 8, 10, and 11. It was published in 1971, and this just happened like in December. I started putting these photos on the scanner and looking at them, and it was just amazing. There is a city. I mean, there's a spaceport, what looks like a spaceport. There's tubes, there's roads, there's vegetation, there's light. I mean, it's all right there. So I sent this one clip or this one photo of 2209 to Beth and Ron, and they looked at it, and they said, this is absolutely amazing. So from there, I started clipping more photos, and we found more and more stuff, and that's how it all happened. And those photos are the ones that you have on your website.
How do we know, John, if these mining operations are ours and not extraterrestrial events?
Well, I'm sure they're part extraterrestrial. We couldn't have possibly put that massive a mining operation together in 40 years. I mean, we could have. I don't think we did. Somebody else is up there. Somebody else built all those buildings. There's no possible way we could have done that.
You think we just kind of inherited them?
Yeah, I think we work with them up there. Now, I don't know who that is up there, but they're the ones that built all that, and we're doing mining. Now, the reason I know that we're involved is several years ago, I ran into a real honest-to-gosh government insider. He's dead now, but he told me three things, and one was that we had been going to the moon since 1962, that the population of Mars was 600 million, and they looked just like us. And the other thing was that he had worked on a piece of mining equipment that was to go to the moon. He said, John, he said, we built this thing down in Alabama, way out in the nowhere. He said, it was so enormous. He said, when we finished the project, he said, I actually rented a little airplane. He said, I'm a private pilot, and flew around this piece of equipment just to get an idea of how big it was. And I said, geez, that's fantastic. How did they get it to the moon?
Yeah.
He said, I don't know. And that's, you know, the deal in compartmentalization. You get to know a little bit of the program, but you don't get to know the whole thing. So he knew a little bit, but he didn't know the whole thing.
What an incredible...
Now, if you ask where the operations are from now and how they keep them so secret, I think it's Antarctica. And if anybody wants to check Google search words, I recommend two things. One is moon mining. You're going to be absolutely stunned at how much there is. I think there's 1,500,000 hits on moon mining and space law and Clementine. Just Google those things and see how much there is.
A couple of these pictures you sent us, specifically the crater Kepler, and then you look at the airbrushed version. Two different, it looks like two different craters.
Absolutely.
I mean, the structures are all gone.
Yeah, like I said, NASA didn't get proficient with their airbrush till about 1972, 73, and they went back and got all these pictures. But those of us who got the early pictures have the good stuff. And on Kepler, you'll see the Lunar Orbiter 3-162 picture. I mean, there's obviously stuff on the crater. There's obviously a strip mine there. There's obviously buildings there. And then you go to the Apollo 12 photo that was taken several years later, and it's absolutely clean. There isn't a trace of anything.
Well, they came down and took all the equipment away. But yeah, you're right. It is absolutely incredible. Now, how do you know, though, in some cases, we're not looking at tricks of light or just different images when you look at this?
Well, take a look at that yourself. I mean, there's buildings on the rim, and then there's not buildings there. Some of the pictures are great. As a matter of fact, Did you see the one of the of Aristarchus? You know, we're always told that Aristarchus is the brightest spot on the moon. We can see it, and any image you can buy or purchase or moon pictures, it's always just a white blob. And so we had a guy take a 10-inch telescope and take a picture for us, and you can see it right in those pictures that we've got on your website. It's a beautiful structure, and it looks exactly like a nuclear reactor to me. It's probably a fission reactor. There's no doubt about it. You can see the arches. You can see the blue glow, and the blue glow comes from when radiation hits molecules of air. And now you're going to say, wait a minute, there's no air on the moon. Well, as a matter of fact, the moon has a breathable atmosphere, and it has gravity 65% of what's on Earth. So, you know, it has it has all of that.
And it looks like it's got some arches alongside of it.
Yeah. And then you look at the next picture. I think that Lex got it up there. Look at that picture that Clementine
I'm looking at that right now.
Can you imagine that we got a better picture of Aristarchus from a 10-inch telescope than Clementine did with a $100 million satellite? Yeah. That's great. I love it.
It doesn't make any sense at all, does it?
It doesn't.
So all this has been going on, you think, right under our noses for 40 years, John?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, somebody pulled up some stuff off the Internet that my father was involved in the middle 50s with Andy Grav, and there's a lot of stuff. If you Google Bill Lear or William Powell Lear, Andy Grav, he was there doing it. He was right in the middle of it. As a matter of fact, there's a 3-minute clip floating around that was originally in David Hatcher Childress' video of my dad lecturing on UFOs at the Bonston Laboratories. And he's there at a blackboard. He's got a saucer there drawn on, and he's describing how it works. The film is silent, but you can see generally what he's doing. Interspaced with the pictures of him are technicians working in laboratories with the balsa wood and paper UFOs. They're obviously trying to make, you know, what was the beginning of our efforts. I think that all came to a culmination in 1959. We made the craft. We may have had some help, but anyway, our first trip to the moon in Andy Grav was 1962. Now, let me tell you this. You say, well, Andy Grav, we don't hear very much about it. And I say, that's right. You don't hear one word about it. You don't see Aviation Week in Space Technology putting, you know, we're working on Andy Grav, and here's the experiments. Nothing. Not one single word. And the reason is they already perfected it, and they don't want anybody talking about it.
I want to get your reaction, Sean, about this talk about why we never technically went back to the moon. Why did it seem to end publicly, yet we continued going back then?
We were already there. That was all a cover. Those guys, you know, the Apollo astronauts, the first guys to set on, they weren't the first guys. That was all just a cover program so that nobody would know about the real program. Now, why they wanted to keep the real program a secret, I don't know. But you can ask, you know, if the listeners want to email Michael Griffin, NASA administrator, they're welcome to do so and say, hey, how come this way? You know, John Lear's got some pretty good evidence here that that we're already on the moon and we're mining up there. What's the deal? You should know. You're the administrator.
What are they mining for, John?
That is a good question. What we think that they're mining for is helium-3. And helium-3 would be an excellent power source if we can get fusion together.
That could power the planet for years.
Yes.
Stay with us, John. We'll be back with you in just a moment on coasttocoastam.com. Our special guest tonight, John Lear. And again, if you have a computer, I hope you do by now, get up to the coasttocoastam.com website. Look at the assortment of photographs he has sent us. Take a look at them. See what you see. We'll be back. And our very special guest tonight, John Lear, as we talk about mining operations, structures on the moon. You know, it was my late aunt, Shafika Corregula, who knew Ingo Swann. And Ingo, through his remote viewing and in his book, Penetration, said that there were indeed structures on the far side of the moon. It's an incredible story. We'll be back with more with John Lear on Coast to Coast AM. Right, John, you've got a lot of people staying up late tonight. Poor Liz in Ann Arbor, Michigan says, George, I'm a college student. I've got to get to bed. I have to stay up and listen to this whole show. It's going all around the country. John, let's talk a little bit more about the moon, and I want to get into some other things with you. The Gary McKinnon story, which is absolutely incredible. He's the one who hacked into U.S. Websites, military websites, including NASA. Back to the moon for just a moment. So you say we went up there in 62. What do you think the purpose was? Was it to begin mining or just to do more military work?
Well, we have a laser weapon on the moon. We have a lot of stuff up there. I don't know all that's up there, but the mining is the big thing. And you might wonder, who owns the mineral rights of the moon? Did you ever wonder that?
Good question.
Well, you'll find that 95% of the mineral rights on the near side of the moon and 50% of the mineral rights on the back side of the moon are owned by a group of three individuals. They're Americans. They've had it for 25 years. And in fact, this same group owns the mineral rights to most of the solar system. And you can check this out in the website or Google Universal Mineral Leases Registry, and you'll find their names. They're government contractors, some of them.
Are they
Dr. Joseph A. Resnick, Dr. Timothy R. O'Neill, and Guy Kramer. And they own all that. Now, how they got it, I don't know, but it's theirs.
I mean, did they have to write a huge check for this?
Apparently, they didn't have to write anything. But, you know, just Google
Weird.
It.
Okay.
Google Universal Mineral Leases Registry, and those three names, Resnick, O'Neill, and Guy Kramer, and they all have little government contractor, little companies that contract stuff to the government. Now, you know, there was a space treaty that said that nobody would own the mineral
rights.
That's
right.
No country. But apparently there was nothing in it that said an individual couldn't own it.
So these three are out there. They're alive and kicking somewhere.
Absolutely. They're working. They've got companies. And they're the ones who hold all the rights.
That's incredible. I got to find them. I've got to find these people. Can you imagine if they are mining the moon, how much money they are making?
Yes. If it's helium-3, they could be making billions and billions. Now, we don't have, you know, the capability, at least that we know of, to use helium-3. As a matter of fact, I was talking to Bob Lazar this evening, and he sent me an email. I said, can we use helium-3 right now? He says, no, it's kind of a future fuel. Once we get fusion reactors working, and on an efficient basis, helium-3 would be a useful fuel. As of today, though, we have no fusion reactors, nor have we produced a sustained fusion reaction. Or have developed the containment necessary to allow the reaction to continue without eventually destroying the magnetic or laser system.
So we could be just storing it up.
We could be storing it up, but you know, the problem is that the plasma generator in the fusion reaction is as hot as the interior of the sun, and it's difficult to deal with the stuff like that. It also generates neutrons, which destroy the matrix of metals, making them brittle and crumble after time, no matter how tough they are. So it's thought that a liquid metal would be better as a shield system, and liquid continually reseals itself as opposed to solid metal that retains and accumulates the neutron damage. Now, what we're looking there in our Aristarchus, that big, beautiful thing there, is probably a fusion reactor.
Is it possible that these structures on the moon might have been created by intelligent Earthlings millions of years ago? You know, looking at that old movie From Earth to the Moon, maybe we went to the moon a million years ago. Maybe there was a very high advanced civilization and they set some of this up. Is that possible, John?
That's possible. You know, we're told that that the Earth is the only habitable planet in the solar system, and it's not. All of them are habitable. All of them have people similar to us: Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Neptune, Uranus, Pluto. They're all habitable things, and NASA calls them giant gas bags. But the only giant gas bag I know on our solar system is spelled NASA.
Now, if you're sitting down for this, Lex tells me he's done some quick research that two of the three players you mentioned about the mineral rights, Resnick and Kramer, he says they were involved with HARP.
Oh, really?
Now, that's an incredible angle.
Yeah.
I mean, they're everywhere, these guys.
They're everywhere. And if Lex will Google moon mining, he'll just see how much stuff is on there. And, of course, NASA says we want to go back in 2020. And what we think is now they want to dovetail their, you know, dovetail this in so that they won't be caught up there, you know, mining. They get this all this thing together where, you know, in 2020, we're going to go up there and mine the moon when it's already there. I don't know whether they want to, don't want to be caught in the lie or what, but when I talked to somebody about this program, NASA's position was, look, John, we don't want to be called liars. If you could just say that we haven't been totally forthcoming.
He said they were on a couple of years ago with Art. We're going to check that and see what they had to say.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that could be an interesting
Excellent.
Maybe they were just talking about HARP. I don't think they were talking about their mineral rights.
Well, they've had these mineral rights for 25 years.
So old Gary McKinnon decides to hack into some government websites and computers and realizes that he's looking for information about UFOs and extraterrestrials, and this guy could get 80 years. I guess he's got to be punished for something. He did break into our computer system, but I'm not sure 80 years is fair. But what do you think this guy was really hacking into?
He was just seeing what he could find, and what he found was a list of the Secret Astronaut Corps. The Secret Astronaut Corps was formed at the same time that the Public Astronaut Corps was formed. But the Secret Astronaut Corps were the ones that were going to the moon in 1962, you know, and here we were just making suborbital flights and then finally an orbital flight.
So they had to shut him down very quickly.
Absolutely, because he has the goods there, and he's getting 80 years for what essentially I'm telling you.
You know, NASA issued a report just a few months ago that said that JPL may be withholding and might have withheld information from us, from the public, and they've called for an investigation. I found that to be an interesting story.
I love it. I love it.
You have looked into the horrible tragedy of Apollo 1, where Grissom, White, and Ed Chaffee died. But you believe there was another astronaut involved. Tell me about that.
Right. That was the fourth thing. I forgot to tell you, the insider told me, is that he was there when it happened. And when the fire occurred, what happened is NSA, the National Security Agency, who control NASA, they went to the top of the gantry there, and they sealed off the area for 45 minutes, and they took that one body out. And what they didn't want anybody to know is that, first of all, that someone was there, and they could, and they wouldn't be able to tell who he was because he was part of the Secret Astronaut Corps. So they had to keep him. The incident quiet forever and ever, and they paid off the family, and it's been a secret ever since, and it would still be a secret if I hadn't found out about it. So I started researching it, and, you know, I got, you know, one of my NASA insiders after, you know, some liquid persuasion, and I got the name of the guy. So if anybody comes to me and says, I think I don't know who that was, say, what's his name? And then I'll know whether he knows or not who the guy was. Now, as you know, at the Bay Area Conference, when I gave my lecture, we had a question and answer period, and one of the relatives of one of the astronauts that burned in the fire got up and said, the story is true. We all knew there was a fourth astronaut killed in that fire. And people say, well, I've seen Apollo, there's no room. Oh yes, there is. There's plenty of room down there. As a matter of fact, the Apollo head, I think his name was Bill Shea, was supposed to be in there that day, and for some reason he wasn't. But there's plenty of room down there for, not plenty of room, but there's room for a fourth guy to help through all those countdowns and some of the problems that happened.
Do you think the initial plans for the Apollos might have been to have four astronauts go all the time?
No.
Just the three?
Yeah.
Well, what a shame, though. Definitely a tragedy. And again, the reason to cover it up is because it was the Secret Corps.
Right.
Jeez. I mean, John, how much of this has been going on and for how long? I mean, it seems like there's every area of government where there's some kind of suppression or non-disclosure or secret. It seems like it's in everything.
Yeah, you know, President Eisenhower warned us about this, about the industrial complex. And it's gotten to the point where, you know, I used to think if somebody was relatively well-informed, if they, you know, read a couple of newspapers, a couple of weekly magazines, you know, kept pretty much on what was going on, that they knew about 5% of what was really going on. Today, I don't think they know anything. Absolutely nothing.
When you were flying planes, did you think, beyond your wildest dreams, that you'd be stumbling into information like this?
Never. Never. I thought, you know, in those days, you know, the SR-71 was the coolest thing. I knew guys that flew it. I was the first guy to find out, you know, where Groom Lake was and start talking about it, and I thought that was the top of the top. What's interesting is there's a group of SR-71 pilots that that get together every 2 years in Las Vegas here. They're called Roadrunners, and what they were the original Blackbird pilots after the CIA. Of course, you know, the CIA started the Blackbird program. There was 13 what they called articles, and those are single-place airplanes. When the Air Force found out about it, that the CIA was flying back Blackbirds, they went to the Pentagon and said, hey, this is not right. We're supposed to be the guys flying spy missions. So the Pentagon turned it over to the Air Force. They went to Lockheed. They made the YF-12A, which was proof of concept for the SR-71. They made three of them, and then they made about 34 SR-71s. The guys that got the CIA guys ran it until about 1967. So anything prior to that, this association is called Roadrunners. And they called before the blue suiters got into them, and they meet. And the reason I'm telling you this story, George, is because when they get together, here it is, 2006, they toast their drinks to each other saying, and we're still the fastest. Now, that airplane, let's see, it's 2006, that's 40. It's 46 years old. Can you imagine somebody thinking that that our technology hasn't improved in 46 years to go from Mach 0.32 to something else?
No, when everything else has, and you add one more year to it as we begin 2007, you're absolutely right. I mean, just look at how the computers have advanced in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
I mean, 40-some-year technology, no, there's no way.
So, you know, when I was flying and involved in that, I had no idea that I would ever stumble across anything like this. And then when I stumbled across it, you know, I met Bob Lazar, and whatever you think of Bob, you know, I believe he was there. I knew him for the 2 years, you know.
And you believe him?
Absolutely, totally, 110%. I went through that whole thing. It's just, you know, people say, oh, you just believed a story. No, I mean, he was the one that, you know, said, hey, John, they're going to test fly a saucer tomorrow night. Do you want to go see it? And me and Gene Huff and him and Bob's wife drove out there, and there is a flying saucer. And, you know, I had it in my Celestron 8 telescope, and I saw it. And so they say, well, you know, maybe he was just a cook up at Groom Lake. And I said, well, if he was just a cook, then they tell the cooks when the flying saucers are going to be tested.
Yeah, exactly. And you're saying these launches to the moon are done at the South Pole?
I believe so, yeah, because if you Google Antarctica cargo, you will see a tremendous amount of traffic going into McMurdo and the other bases around there, a tremendous amount.
And I would guess launches from there would remain relatively secret.
Well, absolutely. And since they're anti-grav, they don't make any noise. I mean, they just head up to the moon. I doubt if it takes more than an hour to get there.
Are you telling me these things travel that fast?
Oh, absolutely. They're anti-grav.
My God. You mean once they get out of the atmosphere? Or from the get-go? Are they that fast from the get-go? What kind of G-force would be on somebody?
None, because it's anti-gravity. You're carrying your own gravity with you.
So there's no G's at all?
Absolutely not.
That is just like warp drive, and off they go.
Off they go. And there's a tremendous story on AboveTopSecret.com. There's a guy that posts there, and you talk about a guy that has been around the universe. His name is Sleeper, and it sounds crazy, but I believe this guy has been there and done that. And he has a blog. You go to AboveTopSecret.com and find Sleeper and find his blog and read what this guy has to say. It's just fascinating.
He knows too much, doesn't he?
Well, he knows a lot, and I just love to read the guy. He grew up in Italy. He eventually went into the Army, and the stories he tells about the Army taking him to, you know, to these saucers and turning him over and walking down these plywood corridors and going off for a month or two are just, I mean, I believe it.
We are starting to get some incredible UFO reports lately, John, by really credible people, you know, pilots again, military people. What do you think's going on? Why these sightings again? I mean, are we just in another flap, a UFO flap, or is there something else afoot?
Probably something else afoot. I think those are our guys. I mean, we've had some fantastic vehicles, not as good as the aliens, but, you know, we do pretty good. All those black triangles are ours. They're not aliens. They're made down at Lockheed. They travel around. This big thing at O'Hare, you know, that's probably us going out there, you know, for some reason, and I don't know what it is, probably to take our mind off Iraq.
That's an interesting thought. I've always believed those were ours. As a matter of fact, I know an editor for a aviation magazine who is sure that those triangular objects are ours. Now, I don't know if they were reversed engineered, but he says what's flying around now is ours, and he says they're always by a military base.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a bunch of new secret bases. There's one in the middle of the Nevada test site. It's not technically Area 51. It's 35 miles west-northwest called Sandia. And it has three runways. They test a lot of things out of there. There's another one up by just to the south of Wendover, to the southeast of Elko. As a matter of fact, there was an article in the Review Journal, Las Vegas Review Journal, in January. Now, I had known about this one particular secret base that was just to the west of Dugway. We followed its progress and everything. It was kind of interesting. I had a friend who went deer hunting, and he was the one that originally found it. So we watched it for a couple of years, and then January of this year, Las Vegas Review Journal ran a story that the military was asking for a third large restricted area over Nevada. Now, there's the Nevada test site restricted area. There's the one up at Fallon. And then they wanted a third one. Guess where the third one was?
Yeah.
Right over this area that's just to the south of Wendover. So, you know, I took it to my friends. I said, hey, looky here. They're putting a restricted area right over this secret base.
I love it. We're going to talk about your theory about the moon being towed into place. That's an incredible one. That's a controversial one, John Lear, as you know. And then we're going to bring in Richard C. Hoagland next hour to chat with John. Richard, of course, his Moon-Mars connection video showed that six-foot-high tower in the center of the visible moon. That was one of the things that sparked John's interest in all of this. We're going to have John and Richard just chat during a portion of next hour. And then the last hour, John will be here for your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM.